if we have a shutdown, those who are not designated as mission essential end up staying home and not getting paid.
Alaskans prepare for the potential federal government shutdown. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 6th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, security concerns prompt Alaska Airlines to make a change in its package shipping policy.
When we initially heard it, we thought it was the end of the world.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Association of Alaska School Boards. AASB believes that all students should be proficient in reading, writing, and math by the time they finish the third grade. More information at aasb.org.
And by
Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com.
The Department of Revenue says the state will have more money this year than it anticipated last fall. Governor Sean Parnell this morning presented the department's newest financial forecasts that show during this year and next, the state will take in $3.4 billion more than was expected at the time of last fall's forecast. Parnell says that's because of higher oil prices. The state's economists now expect an average of $91 a barrel this year and nearly $95 in next year's budget. That's between $12 and $14 higher than projected last fall. Parnell says he hopes the money doesn't trigger higher spending by the legislature this year, and he's setting limits. He says the details are negotiable.
I think we this year can have a robust capital budget and still put substantial sums into savings. The principles of budget discipline that I will ask the legislature to uphold with me include, one, to limit capital spending to no more than last year's robust capital budget, and two, save at least $2.5 billion for the future.
Senate finance leaders yesterday announced that they had already saved $1.4 billion using the lower revenue estimates. House Finance Co-Chair Bill Stoltz says that savings is a matter of definition.
Really, savings I consider if we paid off some debt or burned up some credit card, you know, which they don't seem too interested in. But I appreciate the $1 billion savings, and maybe we can go a little further than that.
The state already has about $10 billion in a savings account. More than 16,000 federal workers are on the job in Alaska, and with a congressional impasse over the budget, they are all wondering what they'll do if an agreement isn't reached by Friday. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
It looks like both sides are dug in deeply, and that could mean some 800,000 federal employees nationwide will be furloughed, perhaps as early as Monday, and that the third largest employer in Alaska, the federal government, also will send many, perhaps most of its workforce, home that day without pay. That bothers Jeff Lipscomb, a civilian employee at Fort Greeley. Lipscomb says he and many other federal employees with whom he's talked are deeply worried about what will happen this time if politicians fail to reach an agreement and the government runs out of money just after midnight Friday.
You know, we've been on this roller coaster now for, you know, several months, with continuing resolution, and then it's going to run out, and at the 11th hour we'll approve it, 1, 2, 3 week, whatever it is, extension. And there is consternation because it's generally accepted that if we have a shutdown, those who are not designated as mission essential end up staying home and not getting paid.
Federal officials say if the government does run out of money, it will be only partially shut down. Federal employees with responsibilities that are considered essential, such as military and Homeland Security and Postal Service, would stay on the job, but would not receive pay until a budget agreement is reached. Employees considered non-essential would be furloughed. Bill Ward, president of the Federal Employees Union Local 1834 at Fort Wainwright, says management at the local level there has given employees very little information about what will happen if the government is shut down. Ward says his union local has filed an unfair labor practice complaint against Fort Wainwright over the issue, and the national leadership of his union, the American Federation of Government Employees, is suing the Federal Office of Personnel Management, or OPM, to force the agency to let workers know what to expect.
Every agency, government-wide, has a contingency plan when they have a shutdown. We've requested a copy of that contingency plan, as well as identification of all essential personnel that would be required to work during the shutdown. They refused to give us the information.
Ward says OPM has given the union's leadership a very basic outline of what employers can expect on Monday if negotiations fail.
Nobody knows how long it's going to last, what it's going to entail. You know, we've spoken with OPM. The understanding we have now, if indeed it happens, everybody will most likely be required to show up for work on Monday. The non-essential personnel will have to take about 4 hours to basically get their stuff shut down.
News reports suggest that federal employees were to have completed plans today on how they'd go about a shutdown. It's expected to be done much like the last shutdown in the 90s. But Ward says this time it's going to be tougher to sort out who's essential and who's not, especially when many of the employees who might in peacetime be considered non-essential are this time supporting the deployment of soldiers, like those from Fort Wainwright serving in Afghanistan.
When you're having a deployment, what about the people that set up the storage for their personal belongings, the bus drivers? They're going to take them to the airplanes. You know, these are all employees that normally would not be considered essential.
Lipscomb, who works in an upper-level position at Fort Greely, says some employees will be able to get by for a while without a paycheck. Others will have a harder time.
Obviously, there are some people who can absorb that, and there are others who can't. You know, so anytime there's a potential for not having your paycheck anymore, that's a concern for folks.
Ward says it's tough for any family to go without a paycheck, especially if this shutdown lasts as long as the last one, and given today's higher costs of living.
I think in 95, 96, it was a three-week shutdown. I don't know anybody out there that can live 3 weeks without a paycheck.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
The president of ConocoPhillips Alaska made his case for lower state oil taxes before the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce yesterday. Trond Erik Johansen pushed for tax reductions proposed by Governor Sean Parnell, including breaks for development of new fields and a reduction in the rate at which the state's production tax goes up with the price of oil. Johansen said cutting back the progressivity factor is the fastest way to get more oil in the Trans-Alaska pipeline because it would leverage development in existing fields.
The best place to look for oil and gas is inside of an oil field. And if you look at these fields, like in Prudhoe Bay, for example, if we improve the recovery mechanism, you know, the way we can get more oil out of the field by only 1%, we will add more than 200 million barrels.
Johansen said oil company investment in Alaska is flat and that each well is bringing up less oil. He said the easy oil has been produced and companies need to invest more to develop thicker oil from aging fields like Prudhoe and Kuparik.
That oil is there, but it costs much more to get out. So it has less margins on it. But as the oil prices have increased lately, that kind of oil gets more and more interesting because it is very expensive to get out. But as long as the oil price is higher, we want to do it. The problem, of course, one of the problems we have here is that as the oil prices get higher with the Alaskan progressivity in the tax system, that upside doesn't go to the, all that upside goes to the state.
Johansen said that's driving development spending to places with less progressive tax rates like North Dakota and Alberta, Canada. He said the industry is making good money in Alaska, but that the state's future hinges on tax cuts to stimulate new investment.
Is it the oil companies that are greedy or what is it? I don't know. It's about, are we going to look just to this fiscal year, next fiscal year, or are we going to look for the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, to create the foundation for the future generations in Alaska.
Johansson said it takes 5 to 10 years before new development projects result in increased oil flow, and that if the state delays too long, new oil won't be available fast enough to avert low flow freeze-up issues with the pipeline. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, lawmakers renew their commitment to the Film Production Incentive Program.
I don't know if stampede would be the correct term, but things are cooking.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
The legislature would have an extra month every 2 years to do the people's business under a bill passed by the state Senate today. The bill, sponsored by Senate President Gary Stevens of Kodiak, would go back to the 120-day limit proscribed in the state constitution during even-numbered years. The 90-day session would still be in effect in odd years. During debate on the Senate floor, Angoon Senator Albert Kukesh said he'd prefer 120 days every year, but thinks the bill strikes a good balance.
This bill has a good argument for those people who voted for the initiative that says 90 days is a better number. We have a compromise. We are going to stick to 90 days for the first session. 120 days gives us the time to do the work for the second session.
But bill opponents like Wasilla Senator Charlie Huggins says not enough has been done to make the 90-day session work.
I guess there's a couple things that concern me as a citizen and as a legislator in this case, is I'm not so sure that we did all we could have to task organize to 90 days. I'm not sure our heart was in it.
The bill now goes to the State House, where a bill to do away with the 90-day limit entirely has cleared the State Affairs Committee and is awaiting a hearing in the Finance Committee. The Senate today also created a dedicated funding stream for high school vocational education programs to train students for jobs that might be available when they graduate. Fairbanks Democrat Joe Thomas says the bill provides a $38 million increase to be shared among local schools to boost the base student allocation. More than $11 million of that money will go to vocational education programs. Thomas says he's learned that in some school districts, vocational education programs have to compete with other programs for enough money to keep them going. He says they're usually classified with special education, bilingual students, and gifted students.
Legal mandates require districts to offer certain special education programs, and often those required programs take a huge amount of the money, leaving little time and money left over for vocational education. We see this in many schools as they've closed down and shut their programs off, and we're missing greatly in that. We also know that the vocational and technical education aspects keep a lot of kids in school rather than them deciding that at the age of 16 or so they can simply quit school and go out and find a job.
The bill next goes to the House for consideration. A bureaucratic tussle over security has forced Alaska Airlines to stop carrying certain types of mail on passenger planes. Most communities have been able to reroute affected parcels, but it's caused headaches across the state. Meanwhile, both Alaska Airlines and the Transportation Security Administration are keeping mum on what it's all about. KMXT's Jacob Resnick reports.
In the back room of the Kodiak post office, Postmaster Bill Kirsch says word came down last week that priority parcels greater than 16 ounces couldn't be put on Alaska Airlines jets.
And when we initially heard it Friday morning, we thought it was the end of the world.
Fortunately, there are alternatives.
We've been dispatching everything on ERA. Now it's been corrected for us, but for smaller communities, it's going to continue to be a problem for them.
The nature of the problem isn't clear, and the two main actors are keeping mum. An Alaska Airlines spokeswoman confirmed that priority mail packages are no longer being put on its passenger flights. She says the airline is working with TSA to address the issue. And TSA spokesman Nico Melendez issued a statement saying it's a security issue and that they're working with the airline to resolve it. So what's going on here?
Well, it's unfortunate that you got to come to us because, because you should have been able to get a very clear answer from TSA and Alaska Airlines. You know, it's not a postal issue. It is a Homeland Security TSA security issue.
That's Steve Deaton, a mail specialist with the U.S. Postal Service in Anchorage.
It only affects Alaska Airlines at this time, and it only affects them in a small portion of the mail flow, which is 16-ounce and above priority parcels and parcel post 16 ounces and above.
In most cases, the Postal Service has put parcels on other flights. For example, Kodiak is served by Air Alaska. Other communities have regular Penn Air connections. But there is an exception.
Now, the only community that this affects currently where there is not an alternate transportation stream is ADAC.
Thank you.
Tiny ADAC, population 326, is the westernmost town in the United States. Its lifeline is the twice-weekly subsidized Alaska Airlines flight. Nicole Gordon manages the general store.
Like our medications, they come priority. Even if they're not even a pound, they still come in the yellow bag, so we're not receiving any of that.
She says people are making arrangements to have medication shipped express, which is a lot more expensive. And she says people are frustrated.
I mean, we really rely on that. That's the only other way. We don't have another airline out here, so we're just trying to get as much information we can. There's nothing online. We haven't seen anything. It's just this one notice that we've got from the postmaster here at the post office, and she didn't really know too much. She's kind of confused about it all.
Here's TSA's statement in full. There are existing security measures in place for all U.S. airlines to carry U.S. mail. Recognizing there may be issues unique to Alaska, TSA is actively working collaboratively with individual carriers and USPS to develop a solution that will result in meeting mailing needs while maintaining a high level of security. TSA declined further comment. Meanwhile, Deaton at the Postal Service says there's a lot happening behind the scenes.
Their intention is not to divert the mail or cause service interruptions in the state of Alaska. They are trying to find a way to work this out so that security is maintained. But I think it's important that everyone understand that this is only affecting ADAC. All other locations, while they may be on alternate carriers other than Alaska Airlines, all other locations in the state are currently receiving all of their mail in a timely manner.
Back in Kodiak, managers have been able to reroute priority parcels, says Kirsch.
But we've got a good handle on it now. Or before, the first 2 days were really kind of intriguing.
Whereas ADAC is still awaiting an explanation. In Kodiak, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
The state Senate today approved a bill to continue funding tax credits for filming television shows and movies in Alaska. Sponsor Johnny Ellis of Anchorage says the initial 5 years of the tax credits has been a success.
I don't know if stampede would be the correct term, but things are cooking out there like we never imagined. A lot of money to be made, a lot of jobs to be had, and it's a very exciting prospect. That means numerous TV shows, cable television has fallen in love with Alaska. And that's a great thing for our tourism promotion. And also multiple feature films have been shooting or scouting in the state of Alaska.
Ellis says the credits are only given after the money has been spent and the production has occurred in the state. The bill passed with no opposition and next goes to the House for consideration. Ward's Cove used to be a major force in the Alaska fishing industry, but earlier this year, the company sold off many of its assets and pulled out of the seafood business altogether. In Unalaska, that sale has had a significant impact on the community, and not in the way you might expect. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
It's Tuesday afternoon, and Alaska Trading Company is a little busier than usual. People are shopping like it's Thanksgiving, but instead of turkeys and yams and potatoes in their carts, you'll see paper towels and ramen noodles and energy drinks. Everything in the store is 30% off. This isn't part of some special sale or anything like that. The store is liquidating, and it's a casualty of a somewhat complicated asset sale made by Ward's Cove, a company that used to be a power player in Alaska's seafood industry.
Alaska Trading, I hear, is pulling up stakes, so they're having a closeout sale. That was what a friend called me up on and said, hey, they have a closeout sale, one-third off of everything.
That's Robert Gruenhagen. He's got two shopping carts, and they're both overflowing. One has what looks like 24 boxes of granola bars. The other has a giant stack of pizzas. Gruenhagen says that since groceries are so expensive on the island, it makes sense to stock up on non-perishables when they come at a discount. The big question for him is, will he be able to fit it all in his kitchen?
The other point of view is how much space we have left in the shelves, in our cabinets, in our freezers. And we got room for 25 pizzas? I hope so.
The Alyeska Trading Company is one of seven Ward's Cove general stores across the state. The other ones are in Hoonah, Nome, and Naknek. Jan Suppler, who is based in Seattle at Ward's Cove's headquarters, says that those stores won't be shutting their doors.
Ward's Cove Holdings is continuing on.
The reason Alyeska Trading Company is closing and someplace like the Hoonah General Store isn't is because the other outlets aren't tied to valuable seafood assets. Last month, Ward's Cove sold its stake in the Alyeska Seafoods processing plant, where the trading company is located. The Japanese seafood giant Maruha Nichiro went from being the majority owner to being the total owner. Since Maruha doesn't specialize in grocery stores, it didn't make sense for them to keep operating the trading company. For many locals, the disappearance of a convenient spot to pick up groceries will be the most noticeable effect of the Ward's Cove sale. But the deal will also change the dynamics of Unalaska's seafood industry. Maruha also owns Westward Seafoods, and now Alyeska Seafoods will be working much more closely with that subsidiary. Unalaska resident Jennifer Lawler was at Alyeska Trading Company for the liquidation sale, and she says that she has some concerns over what this partnership could mean for local workers.
Hopefully everything will work out for the employees, and there won't be a huge consolidation and layoffs. That would be the thing that I would be the most concerned about.
In addition to selling off all of Alyeska, Ward's Cove also sold off its groundfish fleet to two community development groups. A joint partnership of the Coastal Villages Region Fund and the Northern Sound Economic Development Corporation acquired seven trawl vessels, along with 4% of the pollock quota. Both groups have made substantial inroads into the seafood industry in the past year. The Coastal Villages Region Fund is working to move its 24-boat fleet up to Alaska, and the Northern Sound Economic Development Corporation recently acquired a stake in the Bering Fishery Processing Plant in Unalaska. John Eccles is the president of CU Alaska, a subsidiary of the Northern Sound Economic Development Corporation. He says that the group actually had a chance to buy Alyeska Trading Company. But was that ever a serious option?
No. Was that clear enough?
Yeah.
No, it's not a business that we are interested in at all.
The Alyeska Trading Company space is available for development, but there aren't any buyers right now. So when the inventory runs out, the store's doors will lock up, and Alyeska's focus will be on fish alone. In Unalaska, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
The Anchorage Assembly will likely become a bit more conservative when yesterday's municipal election results are certified and its apparent newest member takes office. KSKA's Len Anderson reports on yesterday's election races.
All in all, yesterday's Anchorage municipal election bestowed victories on incumbents, but not entirely. By 10 p.m., Assembly seat I challenger Adam Tromley sensed victory.
You still got the absentees to go, so, I'm cautiously optimistic still. But up by 252 votes, I'm feeling pretty good.
In the yet unofficial election results, the conservative Tromley seems to have defeated the progressive Mike Gutierrez, who was seeking a second term to represent East Anchorage. Although generally incumbents enjoy an advantage, Tromley will be the fourth new assembly member to represent the district in as many elections. Tromley, who campaigned on increased government efficiency, property tax restraint, and improved public transportation for his district, enjoyed the open backing of Mayor Dan Sullivan. He was the only one of three Sullivan-endorsed challengers against progressive incumbents to win. Both incumbents the mayor backed, Chugiak Eagle River's Bill Starr and Southside's Chris Birch scored easy victories. Overall, the mayor was pleased.
That's the way it works in assembly elections. Typically, it's incremental.
Sullivan noted that last year, another of his endorsed assembly candidates had won.
It just shows that, making slight gains over a course of a couple of years can be fairly significant.
Pollster and Democratic Party advisor Ivan Moore saw less impact on the assembly.
I think, really, there'll be a small shift to the right, but I don't think it will have that significant a functional impact on the way the assembly does business.
Moore based his assessment on what he described as the three moderates on the assembly, none of whom had races this year. As for two of the progressives targeted by the conservatives, both Harriet Drummond, West Side representative, and Midtown incumbent L.V. Gray Jackson won by comfortable margins. While much of their opponents' campaign seemed to focus on issues of union contracts, property tax levels, and municipal expenditures, Drummond said in her door-to-door campaigning, more basic issues were dominant.
I've been talking to the voters and learning what they need and what they expect and seeing the conditions in the district. We've got some miserable road conditions and drainage issues, and I learned all about them in the last couple of months, I'll tell you.
Gray Jackson found similar voter concerns about the basics in her district. With the absentee ballots yet to be counted, it appears that a strong conservative effort to gain the two available seats on the Anchorage School Board may have faltered. In one race, incumbent Pat Higgins has a 186-vote lead over conservative challenger Bob Griffin. This was Griffin's second bid in 2 years to gain a board seat. And in the second school board contest, former state legislator Gretchen Guess will now occupy John Steiner's seat. Steiner is ending his third and last permissible term on the board. Guess emerged from a four-candidate field, besting conservative Treg Taylor by a 7% margin. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan had appeared in campaign literature for Griffin and Taylor. The absentee ballots will be counted on April 15th, with certification scheduled for April 19th. In Anchorage, I'm Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Delta, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.